Good evening. My name is Peter Berg, and I'm head of special collections here in the MSU Libraries, and I'd like to welcome you to another evening of the Michigan Writers Series. Thank you for coming out on such a beautiful fall evening. I think you're going to enjoy the reading immensely. As with all MWS events, the reader will read for about 45 minutes. Afterwards, questions are encouraged from the floor. Also characteristic of the MWS, we are live and being recorded, and eventually all this will be put on the internet so that your friends worldwide can also hear the reading tonight. If you want to go to our website, you can go to the MSU Library website. I believe it's www.msu.live.edu/Vincent, and that'll take you to the Vincent Voice Library site where we have all of the Michigan Writers Series events up for you to listen to. Tonight's guest is Patrick LeBeau. Before eventually settling in Battle Creek, Patrick LeBeau was a world traveler thanks to his father, who was in the U.S. Air Force. Upon graduation from high school, he went to Kellogg Community College and then to Michigan State University, where he received his undergraduate degree in English with honors and a master's in American Studies. In 1993, he received a PhD in American Culture from the University of Michigan, where the title of his dissertation was The Codicil Warrior, The Codification of the American Indian Warrior Experience in American Culture. In 1995, Mr. LeBeau joined the Department of American Thought and Language here at MSU. Currently, he teaches in ATL and serves as the director of the recently established American Indian Studies Program in the College of Arts and Letters. Mr. LeBeau is an enrolled member of the Cheyenne River Sioux Indian Reservation. He is a board member of Nokomis Learning Center, president of EAGLE, the American Indian Faculty and Staff Group at MSU, and works with the Michigan Humanities Council on a Rhodes Culture Kit project titled Native Peoples, Indians of the Great Lakes. He has published extensively on Native American culture and history, most recently a chapter to a book on Indian mascots entitled The Fighting Braves of Michigamawa. I heard they're just booted out of Burton.
You're right.
They are. Adopting the visage of American Indian warriors in the halls of academia. He is also at work on a book-length curriculum unit tentatively titled Michigan Indians Yesterday and Today, a Teacher's Guide and Resource. In addition to all of this, Mr. LeBeau is a poet whose work Stands Alone, Faces, and Other Poems was published last year by the Michigan State University Press. Please welcome Patrick LeBeau.
Good evening. Thanks for coming out and to hear me read. I have a cold, so hopefully I won't break out into a coughing fit while I'm doing this, but I'll try my best to read these poems. And I'd like to start with a poem that I had been working on for quite a long time. I had three quarters of it done for many, many years, and it took me a long time to get the fourth part done. And I just put it on the shelf until the inspiration came to me to read to finish it, because I knew that it had to circle back, and I just didn't have that inspiration at the moment that I had most of the poem done. And so I'm just going to read this one. It's called What a Lousy Day for Outdoor Work. Bury me in a pine box with the chocolate and vanilla painted cat, with the complete Sherlock Holmes, with sky and telescope in my chess pieces. I am a lonely man painting this back wall white and green. Bury me in a pine box and get out of this house and take the black dog and the small car with banged out headlights. I'm sequestered in backyard, raking those brown orange leaves left over from last fall. Bury me in a pine box with my white Ford pickup truck with the loaded Winchester Model 64 with Grandpa's World War I helmet and an eagle feather. I ain't feeling so hot agitating this gravel in the driveway. Bury me in a pine box and come home to bake bread and to feed that old black dog and that tired old cat with eyes only for you. I'm not so sure I can care for those bushes, those flowers and bushes left rudely unattended on this lousy day for outdoor work. And I guess the companion piece to that home is locked out. I, outside the window, saw my cat looking at me inside. I'm locked out. Sometimes I wonder if the white and green paint needs a new coat. Only I would paint it sand or some kind of brown. But now I only want to get in. Me in my deerskin coat, ice cream cone in hand, that cat in the living room window, his chocolate ears, face, tail, and paws, the rest of him vanilla, staring at me with those blue eyes. Fucking Siamese, open the door. A long time ago, I was in a Diane Wachowski class in poetry and literature, and I submitted some, or she had us write some poems, and she really, I'm glad she's here because she really set me on the path to writing poems, gave me the encouragement to continue to write poems. And so it's some of the, or this is a really early poem that I wrote. It's called Green Woman. This woman refuses to use electricity. Ha, it wastes strength from her body at the thought of its use. Cooperation, this energy dries her clothes, provides her with light. It is the smells inhabiting her world, keeping her warm. Sweet, moist smell of her husband's sweet breath, pheromones. Like electricity, her body vibrates, her green pharaoh's hair, sending messages to her ancestors. Her son is without adequate vision, yet is a burrow of vision holes. She tolerates this perpetual exploration. Elliot, Rettke, the whining, she sparks the motivation. Her thoughts like jagged discharges of electrical jazz thunder in his head. Ha, the momentary electrifying moonlight providing resiliency to his ephemeral existence. Thinking electricity is weakening, she used to have it when it arrived within her boundary of the nation. Like coyotes, she howled until her husband refused to have it too. Her coyote eyes burned red neon. Gradually, she reduced intensity, glowing, phosphorescent, green. You can believe no one bothered her about electricity after that, ever. Salespeople in Sears and Coast to Coast stores refused to approach her with electrical gadget in mind. They refuse her eyes. They convince themselves she appears poor. She can't afford televisions, radios, electric toothbrushes. The department store catalogs arrive at her home like chameleons without advertisement for electrical items. Feeling the vibrating green hair play jazz to her son, laying in his earth trap, remembering the coyote howl. She smells, a world appears like a green coyote eye. Moonlight encompasses, her husband sweats on top of her. I'm going to read now from the standalone part of the book, Standalone Faces and Other Poems. And it was really the center of my poetry for quite a long time, and I always was working towards creating, linking all the poems together and creating a sequence for them. So I'm going to read them in the way I envisioned them a while ago. Sweet grass and sun. Burn sweet grass, rinse your face with smoke. Eat the moon, slowly, then spit the pieces out. Eat it again, spit it out. Burn sweet grass, wash your hands with smoke. Speak the wind angrily, then cover sky with hand. Speak again, cover sky, dark. Burn sweet grass, bathe your body, smoke, smoke. Lick the earth, sun, don't let it melt. Smoldering sweet grass, cleanse my face with smoke. Deer dragger. Browser. Buck rubs. Your presence is evident. I wait for your return. As deer slayer, food provider fall. Red hoof prints, bloody snow, food provider fall. Animal strength, die, you give for your death. Pollen, tobacco to feed the spirit, food provider fall. Long range, short range, blind behind the branches, give that animal his death. He staggers, he falls. Blood clots, lung shot, whispering, whistling, wheezing song of buck, Provider for the two-legged, steam rises as Buck melts his place in snow. Food provider fall, the will of your dear nation is the strength that drives the rut. I hunger and I am cold. Provide me, dear nation, food provider fall. I feel your warmth, the steam envelopes me, and I feel your spirit feed my animal strength. I seen you jump into your death, well-placed projectile that ended your acrobatic grace. I kissed your wet, warm nose and thanked you for your life. It is the perfect gift, life provider. Ambushed and killed, twilight hour, my patience, your sexual drive made a perfect copulation of life and death. I kissed your tongue and covered your eyes. I tied a wreath of sage and sweetgrass around your neck. I wept for the love of your life, and I enjoyed the moment of your death. I cried for you, food provider, rejoiced in your wealth. I waited, the spirit left, tobacco, steam dissipating, your covered eyes, so I cannot notice the black, cold look of your death. I know that you will live again inside of me. I look for you later, mountain descent, young pine, dusk, smoky haze, time to go. I lift you up, strain on my back. We leave your home, and I drag you toward mine. Grouse sent me home. Seeking the mule deer, I found a grouse, paw prints, hoof holes of dog and deer, crumpled, eyeless, lying still, within a crevice created by dog, stepped on by deer. Both I will be able to eat if old ground bird died from fear, frightened by dog, trampled by deer, create this hunt. You are assigned, dog and deer work side by side, so that when I approach, one will bark, the other will leave, both will escape my attempt to. Or deer is seeking revenge for a ravaged brother, torn by canines, chewed and dragged, a strange thought for a deer. You are a victim and cannot tell, only hunger, starving for flesh. I talk to you, dead on their trail. I seek this deer, now also this dog. What are you, grouse, a decaying, benevolent provider? Kick, kick, I will kick dirt over you, grouse, so I can follow this food trail, leaving my print. I join dog and deer, unable to stop this hunt and wanting at least one more meal. I shoulder my rifle, pick up my pack, head for home, just one more home-cooked meal. Fear of bears. He reminded me of bear smelling. Thoughts had to be hung high in trees or buried deep in ground to preserve or discard them, like spent provisions or perishable food, but like bear, he would try for them anyway. Foul-smelling thoughts rotting like used soup cans, empty sardine tins, and bacon grease. You could not even go to bed with food smell on your clothes for fear of bear investigating and tasting the smell. That is feast to his thoughts. He has a keen nose, that man. I will not tell him I like his land. Suitable only for bears, that did not fear the high climb to his cold water creek. A nice place to fish for both man and bear, that I am not lazy, will wash my clothes before sleeping, bury my waste and hang my food high in trees. Bear is a foul-smelling beast, his presence is known long before he is seen. The same for me with that old man, we smell each other, his bear-like reek and my bacon-greased tin can smell. He reads my thoughts by the food I have eaten, sardines, cold mountain stream, beer and whiskey, bacon, cedar trees, mountain goats, soft women, rough-skinned women, chicken soup, sore feet, tired legs, blistered hands, and next week's pay. He smells of bear, it tells me he is dangerous but kind. He will not hurt me, yet I fear and smell his powerful breath blowing at me. I could eat a bear, I know that he can eat me. I stay as breather and to recognize the smell of bears from the smell of me. I'm afraid to be mauled, carried away, buried in a shallow food ditch. I should be the one to eat him if my fear is as great as his, if I was as hungry inside of me. But I am not hungry. We do not wish to kill each other. Old bear, he is teaching me to survive, and I should thank him. Old man, your kind of smell is disappearing and mine permeating. These thoughts I hide, high in trees, buried in ground, unable to speak them, although you are able to smell and identify them without being able to reach. Strange gift, no reason to hide them, a camper's trick to do so. It is for survival. You are a simple survivor, old man, teaching me to fish like bear, to be clumsy and safe like bear, truly an experience, such confidence to be alone, not really frightened, taking and smelling the garbage of hikers, skiers, and mountain climbers, scaring them away and eating their garbage. A long way back down, I wish to stay like you, man, like bear, but I will never smell as you do. I will return back down to eat my usual breakfast and dinner, only thinking, harboring thoughts like a frightened camper of this climb, only to be found high in trees and buried deep in ground. Hit with a sledgehammer, Grandpa talks about Vietnam. He died for a good cause. He did die literally machine gunned down in active combat. Bullets, the pioneers of civilization, Buffalo Bill said, meant more than just cold, piercing lead. They hit him like a sledgehammer crushing his chest. He also lived. What he lived for caused him to not mind dying. The trees, the grass, the ground, and the Star Nation made him not mind. The jungle reminded him of his life, the cold, jagged earth rock of badlands, the dark pine smell of turtleback-shaped hills, and he would ride the pole fence line. He decomposed rapidly in tropical jungle. Medevac was late. Jimi Hendrix was on the news. It did not last long. He began life when snowflakes were falling. He fought well. He called himself the Frito Bandito, a Mexican-like corn chip bandit, because he wore machine gun ammo belts crosswise over each shoulder like Miss America girls do. America, they called it the world. Grandpa said Miss America reminded him of it. He never made it back. He died bleeding in jungle. He saw the big sky, night lit by star nations, day lit by sun, soft green earth floor, different parts of his mother's body, the same to him, jungle home. Yellow dog in a chainsaw. I guess, you know, Gordon Henry and I used to always notice there was yellow dogs in Native American literature that we read. And so I had to put some in my poetry. And Gordon kind of said he wasn't going to do it just because everybody else was doing it. And lo and behold, in his book, Light People, a yellow dog crops up, and he didn't consciously know it was a yellow dog. So at any rate, look for those yellow dogs. Yellow dog and chainsaw. Dog, you should not have pissed on the chainsaw leaning so fortuitously on the stack-cut timber. Stained snow freezing yellow, the man is too old for an axe. Dog, you better hope your piss is frozen when the man returns from drinking coffee and shoveling ash from the fireplace. Freezing piss coating the workings of the saw blade, nuts and bolts. The man can't find his axe. Dog, you better get the hell out of here. The man wants to boil you, but first wants to shoot you in the throat. Angry beat is lowered. Yellow dog is barking until he puked. Dog, you should not have pissed on the chainsaw with so many trees around. The hiss and buzzing of chainsaws echo in the wood as the man lay dreaming dog skeletons dancing on chainsaws and pissing on the wood. I have to say, too, that this poem comes from an assignment from a Diane Wachowski creative writing class where she gave you a bunch of words and you had to put them together into a poem. And I had this other poem that I'm going to read that follows this, The Killing of the Yellow Dog. I had that one done, so I thought I'd make an effort at putting this poem together. But I'm not going to tell you what the words were. I don't even think I remember anymore. But this is the poem, The Killing of the Yellow Dog. These are like couplets. He stands, feet sinking in mud, his fingers touching gently the hill that surrounds him. His red cataract-filled eyes are unable to mold reflections of tears, of cattle, of home, or of me holding the reins of a horse. The wrinkled touch of his fingers wraps the brown star quilt around his stoic, rigid stance. He is content with the warmth generated by the wind-like movements of arms beating at his side. He is searching for the shiny guitar lying face down beside him. With the fingers, he finds it and he attempts to play. Old man, I have found you knee-high in the prairie grass, coughing, trying to play that shiny guitar that was bought with the alcohol spinning, bought with the cold weather money. You ran over to Yellow Dog when you brought that instrument home. I can forgive you for killing my dog when I see you on the hill, unable to play songs, afraid to knot the sweet air, moving your arms frantically. You are a blur against the white of the sky. He stands, the mud sucking at his feet, attempting to play steel strings that reflect brilliant shafts of yellow gumbo, the thick mud that is always caked on the tires of his white Ford pickup truck. He tries to pluck out a song when the image of the pickup sliding and rolling in the mud enters my mind. The dog was coated with thick gumbo and was buried wheel well deep. Man, you're a willow and a cactus. Your face is reflected in steel, being absorbed by gumbo. I must have dreamed this was so. Yellow work boots trample grass in time while the fingers work steel of guitar strings. The music whines and whimpers, begging for talent, or at least the intricate workings of bones, resulting in the howling of familiar folk songs. He plays unable to brand eyes with browns of cattle, yellows of hills, whites of sky. Old you stare, standing on a gumbo hill, ragged and gnarled and loose cedar bark. The human touch causes great ruptures and splintering. Old and tall tree with barbed wire wrapped around the trunk, reflecting the work of fingers, a thorn lifesaver embedded deep. The line is taut, vibrating the song of yellow-coated wheels sliding in the gumbo. I mourn the death of my dog as the roots and branches touch gently the memory of the man, stout and rigid, now soft as clay. Whiskey and a tattoo. Spirit drank, tattooed on his breath. That is not spirit, that is death. Spirit comes. Lie down, man, lie down. Blow your tattoo on the sun. Lie down, man, lie down. Using your fingers, touch your tongue. Spirit comes. The tattoo is you burning, burning, finger, fingers. The tattoo is you learning, learning, tongue, tongues. Spirit drink, tattooed on his breath. That is not whiskey, that is death. Having macabre drinks of pleasure. He has eyes like moles. He has to squint very hard to see beauty in this world. Yes, he sits in a hole of his own making. A bar stool uplifts him. His left arm dangles, then searches pockets, shirt pockets, then dangles, then reaches. Many would prefer him to leave, or would think him a fragile buffalo leaf or an alcoholic buffoon. His eyes, my man, his eyes squint like a groundhog, his cheeks puff out. He might be drunk. The right hand speaks with signals, the jukebox he is paying, the hamburger clutched by two hands rudely, and the way he scratches and twists the glass that contains his drink. Many drink. Some drink squat in glasses. He sees the liquid as having a brown sheepskin color, the kind he used to tan. Some drinks are moat waters of a towered castle. The watchtower liquid resembles the texture of the tree bark he knows back home, the stuff he made those great canoes out of. He tamed those water snakes with one stroke of carved paddle. Some drinks are lily ponds raised in, cracked into duck eggs, extended on a rod made out of that translucent substance. The liquid is cool and crisp, clear as the turquoise lakes of the Canadian Rockies. He pulls frogs and rounded flat metal from shirt pockets. Yes, he pays for the rich colored kind. He prefers to sit alone. Alone, the smell is rank. She would believe his clothes smell of cigarette smoke. He swivels occasionally, squinting outward. Sometimes he sees splotches of exotic people, splotches of hued clothing, ways of people in circuitous movement. Usually by this time he falls asleep, or it seems that way when he lightly rocks side by side, nudging the people around him. He feels the epidermal fabric of her world. He sinks and presses against that exterior. He sinks warmth, death in the feel of the hot, resilient skin of earth. Resiliency, the vision of his meditation, the one he induced in a crevice of his own making, sweating, hungry, and wanting. He perceived objects, events with no existence in his barroom reality. He wanted to see drinks existing in glasses, Manet, Renoir, patches of paint, anthropological exhibits of barroom mind, beer bottles like chewed fingernails ripped from clutched fingers. He must face glasses alone. His skeletal mass spits. He licks dirt off skin. Provide him the drinks of the creek. He loves to eat the filth of the world. It's like trying to get rid of it. He squints and burls through crowd. In the toilet, he must discharge resiliency of mind and return to drink more resiliency, Catholic holy water, macabre drinks. The bar stays open all night, if you will. Call it a blind pig for no reason. His eyes, my man, his eyes squint very hard to see beauty. Yes, the hole is warm and dark. It stinks and it is dead. It gets a little worse here now. Earth trapped. He lay prone, face in ice. Dead, bloated, half-submerged, icy water. He lay, alcohol spinning in his head, alcohol refusing to freeze his blood. It flowed, circulated a dizzy perception. White snow fell, pressing on his back, a burden driving him down, making him stumble, slip into the ditch, horse hoof prints on his back, making him change, submerged in icy water. He lay thinking, his face freezing, his skin freezing, but his mind thought. Alcohol refused to let it sleep. He lay thinking, he lay knowing, occupied a space between two worlds, a hole, a ditch, to the east, a road, flat top, black top, white lines, plowed, snow dirty with soot, exhaust turning it gray. Snow pressed on him, blanketed, smothering white, ice, water underneath, freezing, binding him to the ground, earth womb, ditch. He thought about that road, that bit of technology, confusing his perception, walking, riding, crawling. He traveled that road. He lay roadside bars and rest areas to ease his mind, to give him a glimpse of what was and what is. A road, metaphor for life, a journey, but this one is made of tar, rock, bituminous material, coal, the guts of his mother. He cried frozen tears when he thought of this, to succeed, to overcome, to demonstrate. He had to press those guts into a sticky form and surface that road he walked on. He stumbled, he fell, he slipped off his horse into the ditch. He had fallen off that road. He remembered neon, roadside cafe, red neon shaped into the word bar. He remembered the road, his glasses broken, his face featureless without them, that bit of technology to give him style. Alcohol kept him alive, his perception blurred. He was frozen to the earth, face downward, he thought. He was merged to the west, the field plowed. The soil churned, the reddish-brown pigments facing the sun. Bonanza, furrow after furrow, he puked all that rotted vegetation. All that bloody land came even out of him until he squirmed with dry heaves and nothing more would come. Blood was the land he lay, blood was the land he perceived. Blood was the air he breathed. Bloody was the world he cared to feel as he looked at it, his guts turned inside out. He lay, steamroller pressing another road over his back, mammoth power lines hammered into his face, alcohol refusing to let him die. Powdery snow fell, icy water filled the ditch. He remained prone, refusing to let his mind freeze, wanting to understand more. Earth death. Somebody spoke, he heard his name. Somebody spoke, he heard his name. Existing, he spoke. Dancing, he heard his words. Not the earth, he dreamed of the sky. Not the earth, he dreamed of dying in the sky. Somebody spoke, he pulled at his ears. Somebody spoke, he tried pulling off his ears. Not beneath this earth or beneath the surface of the sky. Please bury me in the sky. Please bury me in the sky. The ground is cold, colder than the sky. Somebody spoke, he heard his name. He heard his name. Not the cold, only the sky. Not the cold, only the sky. Somebody spoke, he refused to hear. Somebody spoke, he refused to hear. Not the cold, give me the sky. Not the cold, give me the sky. Somebody spoke, existing he spoke, please, please bury me in the sky. Dancing on the surface, he jumped into the sky. Dancing on the surface, he jumped into the sky. Dancing on the surface, he jumped into the sky. Dancing on the surface, he jumped into the sky. Jumping, he slowly died. I was thinking about scaffold burying when I was writing that poem, about how Lakotas used to bury their dead up in the sky. And a Lakota lament. I'm moving to this poem called The Kid. He cried, he knowing why the treehouse was being torn down. Rebuilt, back lawn, hammered back together underneath the big oak. That big tree with limbs sawed off next to the buried milkman's box. That received little boy's secrets, toys and mice and pigtails, chess pieces, rocks and flowers and dead spiders. not simply Ashley Derry's pint-sized glass bottles filled with white milk. He hated milk. He liked the treehouse and the buried milkman's box. Both held secrets and fun, but both were different. The milkman's box only he knew about, but the treehouse he didn't even build. And when he rolled out of the treehouse, when it was 10 feet off the ground, he could still hear his mother cry. Now, God damn it, didn't I tell you somebody was going to get hurt? He did cry a little, but he knew it was fun to jump and pounce, to roll around, even with a split open head with blood gushing out. He cried, really, when they ripped the nails out of the branches and the boards came crashing down. Now the treehouse would not be so much fun, rebuilt back on the ground. He still had the milkman's box, that aluminum box that could hold 4 whole pints of milk. He did steal it from the front porch. He did not know that. He was only having fun. Anyway, the dairy replaced it with another, and he only wanted one, to be buried with little red shovel to hold only his secrets. Dad's favorite pipe, mom's necessary hairspray, brother's favorite Tonka truck, older brother's cigarettes, and sister's love letters. Especially sister's love letters. She was furious. He was only having fun. But the treehouse he liked too. He was disappointed that it had to come down, but it was going to be rebuilt right next to the milkman's box. Would they find it? He hoped not. It was too much fun. The treehouse on the ground, what would he call it? A groundhouse? No, this would not do. He cried for the treehouse to be put back up in the tree. After all, that is where it belonged. Nothing doing. We can't have little boys falling out of treehouses no more. No siree. He was mad. He stopped crying. No siree, eh? Well, I'll teach him. So he began to hide more things. Mom's new wig, dad's automotive timing light, brother's Mickey Mouse watch, older brother's tennis shoes, and sister's diaphragm, especially sister's diaphragm. She was walking around like the Wicked Witch of the North. He was only having fun. After all, he didn't know what it was. The milkman's box was getting pretty full and the lid was sticking out of the ground. The whole family was in an uproar wondering where all these things were. He did not mind. He only asked if the treehouse would be put back up in the tree. He pleaded his case before they got it totally rebuilt back on the ground. No siree. But then his dad noticed the lid. What's my timing light doing in here? And there's little brother's Tonka truck and his watch, my pipe and mom's wig. And what's this hairspray doing in here? And older brother's shoes and all this paper. What the heck is this? Hey, darling, come over here. You can imagine the uproar, the screaming and yelling. He did not understand. He cried. He only wanted the treehouse back up in the tree. What was wrong with that? A long time would pass before he would have any fun. I guess that was the only thing he was sad about. No more treehouse, only a groundhouse, and of course, no more milkman's box. Oh, he did admit everything. After all, he was only having fun. Carol Arnett died several years ago now, and I'd like to remember him by reading a poem. And this was a poem I like quite a bit, so I'm going to read it. He was known as Smoke. And this is a poem. It's called Sweetgrass, Cedar, and Sage. Without the gift of smoke from these three, our lives would end forever. Within that gift, we live on to give that to the children. Wadu, 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 wadu. We're glad. Thank you. Any questions? Comments? Yes. The creative process. He's asking about, I guess, what kind of creative processes I go through to write. Well, I find writing requires quite a bit of energy. So you need to be well rested, well fed. And once those are, even though a lot of ideas occur to me when I'm not so well rested and starving, getting to that place where you put them on paper and share them with other people requires quite a bit of effort. So I find it's the nice quiet spot. I have to have a quiet spot for me to write. Another thing too, I always imagine myself as a bear when I write poetry. And that's just one of those things. I have to get into the bear-like state. That means I'm hungry, and I need to be fed, and I need to sleep for a long time. You know, poetry comes to you like a gift, and poetry comes to you sometimes as a gift, and the poem is completely there, except for minor revisions. Other times it comes as like an unwanted house guest, and the idea is there, but the execution isn't, and it requires quite a bit of work, like me putting that one poem on the shelf for quite a long time. I knew that there was an ending, and I knew I'd find the ending, but I wasn't finding the ending then, so I just put it aside. So, I mean, and then there's everything in between those extremes. So, I mean, it's very complicated. People write in various places. You know, I sometimes get inspired, and I can write, like, in an airplane or on a car trip, but usually I write in the kitchen, basically, I guess. Dining room table. Any other questions?
When did you first begin to write science?
I wrote a poem in fourth grade, and it got stuck up on the bulletin board or whatever, and I liked that. It inspired me. Then I took, but I really didn't seriously start writing, frankly, until I met Diane Wachowski, and she inspired or pushed me into writing poetry. And in some ways, it literally was that push. You know, I just started writing because I had a class to write for and a captive audience in those workshops. And then I just continued. I continued to write. Any other questions out there? Okay. I'm sorry, I didn't. I identify with these poems, but they're also they're a mixture of stories that are part of my own life or my own personal mythology, as well as part of my family and community, and part of where I come from as where my forebears come from, and so I identify the process of I think you were talking about dying. The death? Oh, yeah. I mean, just to having all aspects of creation, you know, the dark side and the positive side, or up and down, or the four directions, all of these things are part of my cultural experience and the way I look at the world. And so you can't have the ground without the sky and that type of thing. And I like to almost to see the sky in the same way as you can see the ground. You know, and we're in between those two elements. And so going into the ground or going up into the sky are similar, but then yet vastly different. And so I think moving around in those elements are just part of the creative process and also part of just sort of the exploration and experimentation that you do where these poems take you. But I don't know what you mean by identify with. Well, I think death, you know, is part of the cycle. You know, there's death and there's reborn. And so, yeah, like when I finish reading a poem like that, I feel really good. You know, sort of a cathartic. You're sort of reborn. I don't know if that go that far, but you feel kind of like that after exploring some of these subject matters and the relationships that they evoke. There's a cathartic experience, of course. I mean, that's some way why we write sometimes. You know, we put it down on paper, and then it's transformed. It seems like it's no longer. You no longer own it in the same way. Thinking about thoughts like that, you know, and you take it out, put it on paper. You don't own it. You're related to it, but you no longer own it. I guess that's a tough question. Yes. Well, I don't see technology as taking away. I mean, it can be very destructive in the wrong hands, but the chainsaw wins in that poem, and it's more like man having to live with these things that now are in their environment, and a lot of them you don't have any control over whatsoever, and sometimes they're just too big. They're so large that more than one man put them together, so any one man can't really confront them in the same way that the many men took to create these like gigantic buildings, and that becomes a source of tension and a source of drama, really. It's and a way of thinking about these issues by setting it up in those kinds of oppositions. Okay, I guess we're winding down here.